Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. Me and the almighty Andrew Dewhurst from Great Up North Hay are here. Andrew, how are you today? Where can you be reached on Twitter?
I'm doing well. You can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. I feel like at times it's weird for you to consider me like up north, as I'm more or less like due east of you, but nonetheless, we'll trek on.
Trek, huh? Perfect. Hey, my concept for the week, didn't get any questions back at least, and let's talk about a little early season strategy. Let's be timely here for once. You know, the first run at Fab happened, and, you know, to me it's a lot like the first players that are brought up in an auction, where the hot names will come at a premium. And we saw some crazy stuff last night, and I was just wondering what your thoughts are on early season strategy. Do you feel like you need to spend some Fab money right away? Do you feel like there's some that you can hold on to for later?
I think it's a little bit contextual. So, like, I definitely paid up for Hunter Strickland in TGFBI. Because I have also had Mark Melanson, so I need those saves, and it was valuable to me to pay up 40% of my total Fab for it. Especially as Melanson has not been good in his time in San Francisco, so I think there's some value there. But for the most part, I feel like it's, you know, you make the small moves and see what happens along the way. I mean, my favorite thing to do at the early start of the year is kind of look for the mistakes, look for people to drop somebody who's valuable, who's just having a cold start, and kind of, you know, take that approach to it, as opposed to trying to jump and grab the guy who had a good 4-day start.
Well, the thing that happened here is that I've been very against, and there's been much talk about other people on staff that are against weekly Fab and only once a week. And Sunday is not a good day for me. I work in the restaurant business, and most of my energy is spent on the weekend, and Sunday is very rough for me. So Sunday I put in for 15 players in my TGFBI league, and I didn't get any of them. I have some players who are coming back, and I missed a couple of them by a dollar. I have some players that are supposed to come back during the week, so perhaps I will fill my roster by week's end. But it is what it is at this point, and I'm just sort of hoping that other people have overplayed their hands. We heard some crazy bids, some bids in the sevens and the low 800s for Hunter Strickland in various formats. So there was a lot of different things going on. We're going to sort of merge. By the way, I am Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. And we're going to sort of merge the Monday into Wednesday podcast. And the names that are on the list, and I gave you no heads up about this, so I'm just throwing you right under the bus. The names that are on the list for us to talk about today, I could put another name in parentheses, a person related to this person baseball-wise, for the reason why we're talking about them right now. And this is going to be amazing if you get any of these right, by the way. So anyway, the first person that we're going to talk about today is in our early season conceptual diagram or schematic here is Trey Turner of the third overall pick in the draft, Trey Turner. Now, who do you suppose I have linked to Trey Turner? That's the reason we're going to talk about him today.
I feel like I have this one, and it's Starling Marte. And the reason why is batting or placement and batting order.
Well, the placement in the batting order is correct. I just went a little different way with it. A lot of people seem to be tying in Adam Eaton, and Adam Eaton coming back to the reason that Trey Turner has been batting sixth, which you know, is the tie-in for Starling Marte. Very interesting and good point that Starling Marte moved from sixth to third, but he doesn't have quite as much clutter in front of him in the batting order as Washington does, because they are such a good offensive team. And Adam Eaton, of course, had a 5-for-5 game already, had another multiple hit game. So Adam Eaton is ripping it up. And I'm not really sure, part part of the reason I put the Adam Eaton question mark next to Trey Turner is it seems like there's a lot more things that could happen here to help him move up in the batting order. The first thing that jumps to my mind is sort of Ryan Zimmerman getting hurt again, because that seems to happen all the time. I put it, Trey Turner on the list because I was wondering if you thought there was a chance that maybe you could trade for Trey Turner right now and get a deal on him. So where are you on Trey Turner right now?
Trey Turner is, I mean, if they're selling, I'm buying. I mean, I'm not making, I mean, he didn't go third overall in drafts by accident. He went third overall in drafts for a reason. He's still hitting 273. Adam Eaton doesn't have the cleanest bill of health. He's got an injury history about him. It's been 4 days. Like, a lot of things can happen. My only concern with Trey Turner is that Dave Martinez is a first-time manager, and his previous experience came as bench coach for the person known as the mad scientist, who can never decide on what a batting order or what the positions are that anyone should play on a given day. So that would be my concern with Trey Turner, is that you don't really know what to expect from his manager. So there is some reason to be concerned. But at the same time, if someone is selling, I don't see any reason to be not to be buying, unless, you know, obviously you're giving up some huge premium to do so.
Over under on Trey Turner stolen bases this year as of this very moment. What do you think?
I would still put it at 40. I mean, for him stealing bases, being in sixth is better than being second, right? It's going to be better for him than hitting, being right in front of Bryce Harper. If he gets on at the sixth spot, he's probably going to be free to run.
I love that you put it that way, because sort of the company line right now that people are toting is that if he hits towards the bottom of the order, well, it does cost him some at-bats, which people don't like, and I get that. But they also seem to think that he's going to too frequently be on base when it's getting close to the 8-hole and the 9-hole, where people are afraid that it's going to, you know, they're going to be allowed to walk the number 8 hitter to pitch to the pitcher instead of having to do it the other way around.
Yeah, but I mean, that doesn't, I mean, for the Nationals, that applies, what, twice a week for the first 7 innings? Right? Like, in the National League, you're going to have pinch hitters for your pitcher more or less anytime after the 6th inning. So I think that, like, I think part of that argument's largely irrelevant.
Andrew, I love it when you're contrarian. I think you're talking to me too frequently, and that's what's happening. My contrarianism is rubbing off on you, brother. All right. So Trey Turner is the first person I wanted to talk about today. And the second person I want to talk about today, and this is one that is almost unfair, the name that I put in parentheses, is Jose Martinez, the 29-year-old potential late bloomer here that has run into everyday at-bats at first base despite all the speculation throughout the spring. And you have any guess who came to mind for me when I brought up Jose Martinez?
The first name that came to mind for me was Justin Smoke, but I feel like that's not the answer.
It is not the answer. I did avoid putting, since you mentioned a Blue Jay, I did avoid putting Kevin Pillar in, who's a player that you and I disagree about, and I'm very happy with my shares of Pillar to this point, and I'm just glad he came so cheap. But actually, Jose Martinez, for some reason in my skull, just gets grouped in with Jose Ramirez, because I see Martinez and I think Ramirez all the time. I don't know. Maybe it's because of the same amount of letters. So this was really a trick question that no one deserved to be asked. But anyway, 3 stints in Major League Baseball and his BABIPs to this point, all small sample size really, except basically last year's, 467, 350, and 444. Been in organized baseball since 2006. Never had more than 10 home runs at any stop before the 14 he had last year. We are ageists in fantasy baseball. No one should be interested in Jose Martinez because he's too old to do anything unless he's the second coming of Josh Donaldson. So what's your take on Jose Martinez at this point?
Chuck, if at 29 we're too old to do anything, we probably should just hit stop the recording right now. But I have some shares of Jose Martinez. I loved what he's done in the first week. Obviously, like everyone else, I mean, he's hitting 455 in the first 4 days. Some of the rhetoric on this gets to be kind of silly, right? Like, we, on one hand, we want to say, you know, he's 29, he's never done anything, therefore he can never do anything. But at the same time, you know, we have a launch angle revolution that more or less, and we have, you know, lots of people out there that pay close attention to changes to approach and change that hitters make, which means essentially from some point forward, whatever they did in the past is almost irrelevant. So I think this is Jose Martinez is the kind of player that you live in the now with, and when he's hot, you're going to love him. And if suddenly he falls off on the map or falls off the map, somebody's going to come knocking and say, I told you so. I told you this guy would never do anything useful because look at what he did in the past. So take it while you can. I mean, 350 BABIP is probably high. But if he runs well and he hits the ball hard, there's lots of room in baseball for high BABIP guys that do it consistently. So maybe he's one of them.
Well, he also plays for the St. Louis Cardinals, which are known have a history of magic pixie dust turning, you know, people like Matt Carpenter, who really was below the radar as a prospect, into fantasy studs. So there's some of that at play here as well. He's also the person at the focal point of my frustration during the drafting season, because despite my protests, I still have a local league that insists on there being 20 games in season before a player is eligible at a different position. So I, of course, in that league, own both Jose Martinez and Matt Carpenter. And it's a weekly league, so I'm foreseeing at some point that Matt Carpenter will have 19 games in at third and 19 games in at second at when a week starts, and I will not be able to use him at any other position besides first base until after the All-Star break, which will literally have me ready to break stuff and run my finger through the eye of a small child. Because I think that rule is so stupid. Do you agree with me that rule is stupid?
20 games is a little much. Like, I think 10 games for eligibility, 20 games to keep it for the next year makes sense. I mean, I hate the, like, I don't like leagues that are like, I think 5 games is not enough. Or the one, like, doesn't Yahoo use like one game at times?
Does it have to be one game in Yahoo? I'm not exactly sure.
I'm not sure. Oh, but like, now that the Astros are doing like 4-person in the outfield shifts at times, like, what's that? That's just going to create a lot of confusion.
You know my Kirby Puckett story? Have I told you my Kirby Puckett story?
I have not.
The first year that I played, we played American League only when the Brewers were still in the AL in the early 90s. And we used one game eligibility. And in drastic situations at the end of the game, the Minnesota Twins would bring Kirby Puckett in from the outfield as an extra infielder, and he qualified at shortstop every after he played shortstop one time. And so that just drove Kirby Puckett's draft price just right through the roof. And the idea, in an AL only, you could use Kirby Puckett at shortstop.
Oh, so, wow. Yeah.
Anyway, but I think 20 is too much. I've got a plan now. Next year, I'm going to go into the draft and see if I can nudge it down to 15. Because 15 at least would just be a little skosh better. You know, I just don't like the idea of a guy starting the year as a player on the team, going a full month playing there, and just because a day's off, or if he gets the slightest injury. You know, if Matt Carpenter goes on the DL, he might not be eligible at any other position but first base until, like, the end of the season. That's what it feels like right now, even though I know he's playing all over the diamond, and they trust him all over the diamond, which is what I don't like about the rule. But anyway, I digress, which is something I'm not known to do. I'm, if anything, I'm a little bit too much to task, if anything. So let's play this little game since we are, and get back on the Jose Martinez train. Over-under for Jose Martinez home runs this year.
I can answer this by not answering and say league average. Whatever league average is, I think that's what I would put the over-under at. I don't think he's going to be like, I suspect it'll be similar to last year, which I think was about 23. So I would probably say maybe give him a little bit, say like 26.
26 home runs. Okay, I will take the under. At the draft cost that I got Jose Martinez for, if he manages to hit over 270, I think I'm just fine with it. I also used him a lot because of the versatility that he was outfield eligible. I don't know how he got that many games in the outfield. He doesn't look like he could play the outfield when he's playing first base, but somehow or another it happened. So
Hey,
I'm going to use it and abuse it for this year. And if he does most anything, if he hits even 18 home runs this year and plays all year, I think he's going to be overdrafted next year. So at least I got on the train at the right time.
if Aaron Judge can play center field in the weekend, then I feel like there's a reason to believe that Jose Martinez can too.
By the way, I owned Aaron Hicks in TGFBI, then or in the head-to-head league for the league. I owned Aaron Hicks, picked up Billy McKinney because that's an 18-team league and it's that deep. And I thought, well, I might as well take the gamble on Billy McKinney, and he played one game and then got hurt as well. So I did. So I do have that underneath my belt already for the season.
And it's snowing, and the Yankees game today is delayed because it's, or canceled because it's snowing. Well, rescheduled, I
Yeah,
suppose.
I'm trying to figure out if they can't play in, if they can't play in that borough, how are they going to play the Mets game tonight? That's not happening, is it? Anyway.
The difference is, the sun will probably come out and melt the snow. It'll just be really cold.
Because they haven't postponed the Mets game yet. I noticed that. And the Mets are at home tonight, I believe, against the Phillies. Okay, let's talk about the next person on the list. And he is the aforementioned Hunter Strickland. Any guess as to who I have in parentheses here?
I'm not sure. I'm going to guess that it would be Sam Dyson.
Sam Dyson is a really good guess. And I owned Sam Dyson last year. For the bad part of the year, and I actually in NFBC I got to bring him back for some saves at the end of the year in San Francisco. But he had a terrible spring, and it didn't end up being him. And this is the toughest game I've ever made anyone play, just so you know, Andrew. I appreciate you even playing along, actually. The person in parentheses that I put was Scott Kingery. And the reason that I put Kingery in parentheses is because if you remember back to before the season started, I have some leagues that run multiple fab. And Scott Kingery went for some absurd amounts of money. Okay? And that was before whatever this debacle is that's going on in Philadelphia started happening. This sort of Joe, this new version of Joe Madden, maybe without the managerial background needed to try and pull off these bits of craziness. And so I put Kingery in, which was only really aligned in, with Hunter Strickland, just because I was curious as to if some people may be regretting their move of dropping so much fab and doing so much to acquire Hunter Strickland. In 3 years before this, he had a 2.64, a 3.1, and a 2.45 ERAs, but only five saves. The managerial confidence in him has obviously given him a bit of a boost this year because, for some reason, over those last 3 years, the Giants were absolutely petrified of giving him the closer job. They had ample opportunity to do so. Do we remember the Santiago Casilla experiments and the 2 years ago, I believe it was, where they were using almost anyone they could possibly think of to close, and they still were not using Hunter Strickland to close? So, I give him credit. He's had 3 good years in a row. He's managed to be up over 8 Ks per inning, but he still hasn't had the gig. I understand people in certain situations, like what our friend Andrew Dewhurst has gone through with owning Mark Melancon in a league, which is easy to happen in these deeper leagues that that we're in. But at the same time, I'm hearing stories of people bidding $350, $400 of their fab, 35%, 40% of their fab, when they have three closers already. So they just think they're going to stockpile this extra attribute and maybe be able to trade later. I'm not exactly sure. Daily lineup leagues, I understand it more. But I wonder if you have any inherent fear in being so vested in a guy who has really never had this gig before.
My concern isn't so much in that, because I mean, if he struggles, it's on to the next guy and on to the next guy and on to the next guy. I mean, I'm more concerned about the Giants turning back into the pumpkin they were last year. Like, if the Giants are the second worst team in baseball this year, as they were last year, you know, how many save opportunities are they even going to be there? Which means, forget, like, yeah, you just blew, not only did you blow 40% of your FAB budget on Hunter Strickland, but you also wasted a useful draft pick on Mark Melanson. So, I mean, I feel like in these questions, there's always reasons to be pessimistic. That's just the way it goes. I mean, there's like when we look at, I mean, I think I put 421 or something. Matt Thompson said he put like he got, I think he said 460 or 470 to get him. And I'd heard of what, $711 to get Strickland in an NFBC league in our staff chat. So I think when you get in a mode where you're chasing saves, you're going to be chasing saves. Paying up a huge amount of your FAB, I think, on a reliever when you already have three, like three guys for saves seems a little crazy for me, but I mean, to each their own, I suppose. Everyone's got their own strategy, right?
Yeah, and like I said before, I think people, you know, this is the height of people's fantasy baseball fervor. Clowns like us, we have a lot of fantasy baseball fervor year round. I could start drafting next year's fantasy teams. Matter of fact, we do in the three sport league. We start drafting our fantasy team for next year before this year is even done. But there's a lot of people out there that, you know, they want to be in the thick of it for as long as they can. And they're really into their team right now. And so they're going to go out and they're going to make these dramatic moves and they're going to see how it turns out. And that's part of the fun. I don't want to come off as someone who is a pure hater of this. The one league where he was still available to me is TGFBI. And I have three closers who are all actually closing and pitching pretty well. So I couldn't see in a weekly league, in a daily league, had this league been daily, I could completely see it. When you're not using a starter, then you put in. But how was I going to get four relievers in my lineup every week anyway? My starters would have to be putrid for me to get four closers in, you know? And so I just didn't like the concept of me being the person that was overspending on this particular player. And so maybe that brought out the reactionary person in me and said, "Wow, I mean, this is a lot. This is throwing a lot of faith." And I will say this, my wife was sleeping, you know, took a little cat nap during the Giants game last night. And when she woke up, she looked at me and she said, "What's the score?" And I said, "It might as well be 58 to nothing, because the score is 7-0 right now, and the Giants are not going to score 7 runs in the next week." Like, I understand. I don't know if you saw I don't know how closely you follow Twitter, but I put out this tweet last night that said, it's not, to me, it's not that the Giants scuffled so bad against the Dodgers starters that would concern me. It was the fact that when you're up, when they were up 9-0, the Dodgers are bringing in the back end, the deepest part of their bullpen, and the Giants still look like they had no chance to score a run. You know, and I don't want to be, you know, we just talked about if people could overreact to the Red Sox really not having a good offensive start to this year when they scuffled some in the last couple of years, especially since Ortiz retired. You know, if there's an overreaction to it, and maybe there's an overreaction here as well. But it just seems like more of the same old story. And while Evan Longoria and Andrew McCutchen were upgrades from what they had last year, they're also guys that the main perception is that they're in the twilight of their careers, which is a little unfair to McCutchen because he's not that old. But the point being is now we have a little evidence to start working from and building off of that the Giants offense could be absolutely putrid. How do you feel about the Giants' offense going forward? I mean,
I would try not to overreact too much to the Giants' offense. Like, it's not as if they were playing, the Tigers or the Royals for the weekend. I mean, it's the start of the year, playing the Dodgers. If the Dodgers have nothing else, it's a lot of starting pitching. And I mean, Sunday nights are down 7-0. I don't worry about that stuff too much. It's funny that you mentioned about running out four relievers in a weekly league. I did do that, and I continue to do that actually in TGFBI, as I'm running with two middle relievers and two saves guys, especially while Greg Holland remembers how to play baseball and sign contracts, and Mark and Melanson's hurt. So I'm actually using Chad Green, Yusmeiro Petit, Hunter Strickland, and Wade Davis. But through 4 days, this has actually not worked out too badly, as I got 6 2/3 innings from Chad Green and Yusmeiro Petit to go along with 8 strikeouts. So.
Well, I'm really glad that you brought that up, actually, because one of the things that's happening early in the season is, Lance Lynn signed late, and he wasn't going to start until this week. You also have the Arrieta thing, where he's not supposed to start until Sunday. Now, I told my wife, I said, she asked me if she should start him, and I said, there's so many chances for bad weather between now and Sunday that to go an entire week without pitching to get someone's first start of the year, I don't think I can do that.
Well, I wouldn't start him. I mean, like right now, like Gabe Kapler, he might throw four perfect innings and get pulled.
Yeah, I mean you're also should throw that into the mix. So the point being is that there is a lot of situations, and I think Justin Mason was right to laugh at me, and it was laughable that when Michael Feliz came in and gave up four earned runs on opening day for the Tigers, without recording it out, he was in my lineup in an NFBC league. And I had three relievers that were hurt, including the two Phillies guys, Neshek and Neshek and
There's yeah,
Hunter.
right.
And I went and I said, well, this guy throws, almost 100 miles an hour. He was just acquired. They were scheduled to play each day of the shortened period. I'm like, I'm gonna put Michael Feliz in my lineup. He recovered though. His ERA is down to 36 now. So he did recover. I don't have the infinity to look at for the rest of the season in my active player stats. But I wonder how many people had David Robertson in their lineup yesterday. I'm betting there was plenty for this exact same reason that I had Michael Feliz in my lineup. Like, if you needed to put a long reliever in, or you needed to put an extra reliever in, Robertson was a very likely candidate to be in. So I think there was probably a number of people who had that as well. And since we're talking about relievers a little bit here, Felipe Rivero, what a nice boost for his owners. I mean, he struggled in that in. He's a little too amped up for his first save opportunity, but he gets two saves at both ends of a doubleheader yesterday, which I think was a really nice bonus for his owners. As long as we're ranting on closers, let's just keep going. And we can keep ranting on Gabe Kapler, too. And I'll tell you, he's the guy who I had in parentheses next to this guy, and that is Hector Neris. He took this big step last year, which was a 4% drop in his home run to fly ball rate. His home run to fly ball rate right now through an inning and 2/3 is 50%. I will say that that is not going to be his percentage for the year. I do think it will go down from there. I don't think that he will get a lot of save opportunities if the home run to fly ball rate stays at 50%. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah. I don't think there'll be a whole lot of opportunities for anything if the home run fly ball rate stays at 50%. But I wouldn't worry about that too much. I mean, I guess first of all, the player who you would have in parentheses, I'm not sure. A name doesn't come to mind, but I feel like it would be somebody who should have been the closer for a while and then eventually got the job and then has struggled.
How about Blake Parker? Maybe Blake Parker is the right name.
Could work.
I'm
You could probably also use Cam Bedrosian in that same spot. Just about anyone else that's closing for or whose people have speculated to be the closer for the Angels.
Is it just me, or has this this closer insanity gone beyond what it used to. Like, it used to be that managers never really made any comments about what was going on, which was frustrating at times. But now you have sort of misinformation. Okay, you have the obviously Keona Kayla wasn't going to be the closer in Texas because they announced that Tim Lincecum was going to be the closer, you know, or had a shot at being the closer, which of course hasn't developed yet to this point. You have this, well, Cam Bedrosian is likely to be the closer in in Anaheim, and then Blake Parker gets a shot and gives up runs in both of his first two outings. So now people are speculating on like four people in their bullpen. Then you have Brad Brock, that whole saga going on. Then, I mean, it's one thing after another. Is this insanity not worse than what it used to be?
It is. I mean, I think there's a few reasons why, like, the way people think about relievers has changed. And not that I think that's necessarily relevant in these cases, and that, you know, there's more thoughts of you should have your best reliever pitch in the highest leverage situation as opposed to just keeping him around to pitch the last inning, which I think plays into some of this stuff. I mean, the other thing that plays into this is that the men who manage professional baseball teams owe fantasy baseball nothing and don't really care what we think about it. So, I mean, if the Orioles want to not use Brad Brock in the save situations, I suppose they're welcome to it. I mean, there's lots of these situations, I think, over the weekend, and that I guess the other thing that now plays into it is now teams are concerned about arbitration money out of all of a sudden. And, you know, we don't want to use our best players to close because we don't want to have to pay these guys closer money in arbitration. We want to pay them regular reliever money, which is significantly less money. So, I don't know. It's all a mess. Like, I think what it's going to do for fantasy baseball is it's going to, if this trend continues, you'll see more and more value and higher picks taken on guys like Kenley Jansen, who are, you know, guys that you think are guaranteed to close. And you'll see, you know, much less value placed on the rest of on the middle tier and lower because it's so unpredictable.
Well, it's funny that you mention arbitration because, arbitration, I just always have this image in my head, is like this Cro-Magnon whole function. I mean, when you speak of arbitration, like, you have people at the highest level of professional sports. They are oftentimes quibbling over $400,000 to $600,000 of, you know, a $4.5 to $5 million salary. And they're going to sit in a room across from each other, and the owners hire someone to go in and say, well, this guy only saved so many games, and he wasn't available this amount of time, and he's not as good as he says he is. And the player looks across the room and says, oh, yes, I am. I did this and I did that. It's like it's like you would expect children to argue with each other, is sort of the base of the arbitration process. And we all know that these middle relievers are enormously valuable, and yet this Cro-Magnon device that they use is so far behind the actual times that it holds down their arbitration value if they come in and they don't let inherited runners score, but they work a clean inning against the 7, 8, and 9 hitter.
Yeah,
it's the most absurd thing, and it goes along with all the craziness. The fantasy baseball is this numbers game that you can play so logically, except for closers. The one thing I want to point out that we didn't mention is, if San Francisco's offense is as bad as it could be, that might actually help Hunter Strickland. Because if they win two games a week, but they can't score enough runs for it not to be a save opportunity, it automatically has to be a save opportunity. I mean, there is precedent for Guys, the one thing that happens is I was joking around that the Cubs have this tendency to just shun save opportunities traditionally. They're the new version of the Cardinals used to be this way like 10 years ago. They would win a bunch of games and they would win by 6 runs or lose by 5 runs. Like there was, you had a hard time even finding time to use the closer, let alone have the closer have save opportunities. Jason Isringhausen was known for this. He'd have these great years statistically, and at the end of the year, you'd look and you'd say, "How did he get 21 saves only when they were the second best team in baseball?" And and so there is no right or wrong answer necessarily to closer issues in general. And I think you pointed that out well when you said, when you end up having to search for saves, the madness is going to ensue, and there's going to be very little you can do about it. I equated Hector Neris to Edwin Diaz, is kind of who I thought Hector Neris was, the pitcher. They came into the league and into their roles at about the same time. They both had minor hiccups. Remember when the Phillies were going to use Neshek, and what have you. So they sort of came in, and I thought, well, the Phillies on paper, the Phillies should be kind of good. So in early drafts, I drafted Neris, and then I found out this narrative was going on about how the role was going to change and how, how much of a mad scientist Gabe Kapler was going to be, which is very unusual and unprecedented for a new manager. Usually, a new manager would come in and try and play things pretty much straight to the book, straight to the cuff. And that is not at all what's happened with Gabe Kapler. And it does turn out that Edwin Diaz is the guy I wanted, not Hector Neris. Not that I ever took Neris over Diaz. I don't think I was ever afforded the opportunity, actually. So it is what it is.
That's going to wrap things up this week. I'd like to thank Chuck Anderson for hosting the show. You can find him on Twitter at just chucking it. I'm Andrew Dewhurst. You can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. I'd just like to thank you for listening again and have a great baseball season.